We're talking about the use of terms without bothering about the implications of them. Most of the vocabulary that we have is the vocabulary acquired as children without definition. There is an index, as when you point out something to a child and say that is a pot, that is a plate, that is a cup. You indicate, but don't define, and particularly not the implications. So children are told to be naughty or not naughty, according to the mood of the person. No definition is given adequately to cover the implications of the term. We'll use this particular word, unique, to indicate what we mean. Now, the important thing to note is this. Human beings are unique in the world of living beings because of vocabulary superiority. They have more sounds, more articulately manipulated than any other living being on earth. But these sounds are learned in social situations with emotive tones, so that when you hear a particular word, you don't merely get a pure phonetic, a unit of sound presented to the hearing apparatus, but it is accompanied by references to other things, and therefore is relational, and to emotional tones accompanying the words offered to you. Now, Greta offered this particular word, so I can ask Greta what she would mean if she said something was unique. First I'll ask her where she acquired the word. Did you go to the dictionary, Greta?
No.
Did you hear it when you were a child?
Did I hear it when
you were a child? Yes. And did it have a particular auric association of feeling about it? And did it seem to you that it was a good thing to be or a bad thing to be?
Good thing.
Good thing. Did anybody tell you to be unique is good in those words?
Not in those words, no. To be oneself.
To be oneself. And if one were oneself...
In fact, no, when you say that, I think it stems from the school days, to be better than the others.
To be better than the others. Mm-hmm. So there's an implication that if you're unique, emotively, you're more important than other people.
Yes.
So there's a man like Jack the Ripper, who was unique in his way, must have been better than other people in his own field. Yes? Now, this is true, that we do acquire terms as babies without adequate definition, and with emotional overtones which condition the way we react to the word. So if we draw our famous three-part man, the think part, the feel part, the will or action part, in that way, we'll put a spinal coordinator down the middle. You hear a word which goes through your little place there and is recorded in the brain. So that's in the think department. The sound has a form. The sound of the vowel E and the vowel R and U are different sounds, and they have different emotional connotations. They go in to the ear, they record themselves in the brain, and then they have feeling associations, because the voice that speaks the word gets its air from the lungs. If that looks a bit like an archaic symbol, it is quite correct. It is a phallic power. We'll see what we mean by that in a moment. The voice itself is phallic. Yes? Let's see why. Because that letter, the PH, or phi in the Greek, means a situation penetrated. A situation substantially made of energy is penetrated by another energy, and in the way that it is penetrated, there is a wraparound, the penetrating energy, and that is represented by the L. So the function of philosophy and philosophy are very intimately related. The superiority of the human being over the animal world depended upon the human being's capacity for mimicry. You know that human hunters copy the sound of birds and of animals that they're pursuing. And they can dupe an animal into thinking an animal is there, when really it's a human being voicing an animal sound. So the human superiority to the animal consists in a mysterious way, as the ancients in all the major religions said, somehow man is total animality. He's not just a snake in the grass, he's a kangaroo and an elephant. And anything whatever that any animal can do, man can impersonate effectively enough to dupe the animal. It doesn't matter that today we use electronic instruments to dupe animals, and we can do this very easily. We can actually draw on the edge of a film a geometrical configuration which, when played back through the instrument, will give the sound of a cuckoo, enough to deceive a cuckoo, because we can analyze the sound made by the cuckoo, and we can record it, put it on an oscilloscope, photograph it, draw it on a piece of paper, modulate it, draw it on the edge of the film, play it through the film, and fool the cuckoo. Now, the other animals don't do this so efficiently. Many animals mimic and deceive each other, protective colouring, and the colouring of predators like the spots on the leopard or the stripes on the tiger. There are methods of deceiving by misinforming. They inform you amiss. The stripes of the tiger in the bamboo, the spots of the speckled light of the forest with the leopard, are deceiving tricks. Now we want to examine this very carefully, because the phi lambda there, those two fundamental letters in philosophy and phallus, are set in opposition with another word, lu. I'll put the S at the bottom. Phi lambda means reason, because the circle is that whereby we circumscribe any situation whatever. We make a Venn diagram in this way. We analyze it with logic. We cut the circle in various ways. The symbol of the cutter is the rod, so that the letter O symbolizes the situation in its passivity, the feminine aspect, and the rod symbolizes the interfering force, masculine aspect. And because the rod laid across that circle will divide the circle in a certain way, it gave rise to the concept that we call pi ratio. Pi ratio. If you remember that the letter L and the letter R are the same letter produced in the same part of the mouth, but in the case of the L, you just wipe it once. In the case of the trilled R, you repeatedly wipe the tongue there, and this trills, but in the same place as the L. So the difference between the R and the L is that the R is rapidly differentiating while the L is binding together. So when we look at this pair of letters, the phi and the lambda, the F sound and the L, together they give the method of logical analysis. A situation cut with some device, penetrating it and dividing it into right and left, and thus giving rise to the concept of ratio and relation. And the word relation means to lay a thing back on another thing. If we take the circle and put the rod on it, we see immediately that the two halves of the circle are symmetrical, and we can fold one half onto the other half, and that is to relate it, to lay back one half on the other half, and the figure being symmetrical, the two halves are congruent and equivalent to each other. And the use of that little concept by the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Hindus was that they were creating a device for analyzing any situation whatever that could be circumscribed. Now, when the process of rationalization, that's philo, was completed, the function of the analysis having been made obvious, you did not need to be bound by your logical analysis. You could disobey it if you wished. And therefore, the word loose was used in opposition to it. First you make your philo rational analysis, and then you let yourself loose from it. Those are called in religious terms two keys, one of binding, one of loosing. The binder is falla. The looser means to play. The other word loo, apart from the place where people go to meditate, is also the same base in the word ludo, a game, ludere, to play, and so on. To let oneself loose from the logical implications of one's analysis, having performed the analysis, you then have two conditions. A thoroughly rationalized situation, phala, and a liberation from the analysis, loose. Both together constitute the basic weapons of the science of the last 6,000 years. Phala loose. That means make your analysis complete, down to every minutest detail, and then having made it, cut loose. Plotinus put it in the way, first perfect your reason, then take the flight of the alone to the unknown. Loose yourself from your definition. And why should we? Well, we've made a perfectly rational analysis of a situation, mother, to cut loose from it. If our analysis is perfect, had we not better keep it? Well, let us keep it, but are we to subordinate ourselves to it? Once upon a time there was a thing called Euclidean geometry, and it was supposed to be absolutely self-evident, self-consistent, beyond argument. Triangles have three sides, and the number of degrees in the three angles added up to a certain number, which some of you might remember if you are young enough, and that was invariable. But if you actually drew a triangle on a surface, it was flat. You could demonstrate that and measure it. But supposing using the same motions with the same compass, you drew that same form on the surface of a sphere. Now the lines would then be curved, and the number of degrees in the angles would not be the same. So then we have another kind of geometry. Instead of a two-dimensional flat geometry, we have a spherical geometry. And in fact, we can make an infinity of geometries by drawing the same primordial shape on different shapes of surfaces. So those people who, for a couple of thousand years, were intimidated by the Euclidean definitions, found it very hard to accept that there were other kinds of geometry possible. Geometry was established and perfect and beyond argument. But we can draw geometries in spaces which are electromagnetically fluctuating at any given moment, at a given periodicity, that would break all of the Euclidean rules. Therefore, we can say this: when we have made a complete analysis in a given situation, and we can say, fa-la, 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 we've done it, you know, that occurs in a lot of songs, folk songs, doesn't it? The fa-la, fa-lo, etc. Which means I've really got control of the situation. That would be fine if the universe were static. that the universe is not static. The universe is nothing but energy in a perpetual state of flux, moving from an earlier condition through time to an open-ended, undefinable. And on the way towards that undefinable, it is going through myriads of changes that make it necessary for us to throw our phala away and be loose. Therefore, loose means not only not tied, it also means light. It's directly related to play and the lux in the Latin light, and the lum, as in luminosity, all come from the same base. So that we have, in fact, a strong warning in one word, phallus. Phallus means define it, but do not be intimidated by your own definition. Now, it's obvious that the first beings to discover this process, the very careful formal analysis of a situation could give you control of the situation, providing no other beings had made the same analysis, and providing the situation remains sufficiently slow changing for your analysis to be applicable. Now it happened, and I think you will find this through personal self-examination, that the beings who discovered this process were rational beings. They were men who discovered it. Males discovered it, and then we're going to see why. It was a function of vocabulary. And the shape that we drew inside here is a phallic shape because it was through shouting and mimicry of the animal world that certain beings discovered that they could influence, flow into a situation with words, sounds, very economically. That is to say, a big muscle man might want to thump a small man into obedience, but when there are lots of small men about, it often became inconvenient, and if you had a tribe of a few thousand, you might not have time to get down and thump them all. And then one day, a man thought, if only I can invent the word thump, and then ask the whole tribe in a formal gathering, would you like to be thumped? And demonstrate what thump means in public, then the tribe could decide whether they liked it or not. You know that the result of this brilliant idea was a gathering together of the peoples, an announcement made to them by an articulating being, and he defined the situation, and he had large muscle men with him and a few captives to demonstrate on. So that you could get a man, you could have him thumped in public and say, listen to this sound. Now we'll say, that's a thump, it'll do. If I had a bigger chest, it would be a bigger thump. When this sound is made, say, when you hear me say this word, thump, I want you to visualize this big strong man hitting this little weak man. And then, having demonstrated it now, who else in the audience would like a thump? Who would like to demonstrate this? Have we got a small, not too strong person and a large, strong person in the audience who would be prepared to demonstrate this for us? Or would you say that your imagination is enough? Imagination is enough. The only reason that imagination is enough is because you have ancestors for thousands of years who have been seriously thumped very hard in public, and their protoplasm has been modified, and the continuity of the protoplasm from generation to generation makes you not need a demonstration. So that means that you are fundamentally nervous about a word because of its emotive associations based on some form of physical activity in the original demonstration. So, we will examine this unique word. Obviously the first part, the uni, has a meaning. You hear it in other words, unify, unit, and so on. Now, let's analyze it in its primary phonetics and see why it means what it means. The U, you form that U sound. In English you say U because the English are very good at distorting everything. But in most sensible languages on the continent, that same letter is U, not U. The English use diphthongs where decent people don't. The U means drive. It means push. It means force, moving. Just when you see that U, if I draw you U in ancient Egyptian, I'll draw it for you. I hope it's big enough. And if I draw it in Hebrew, that's like that. That's a wow, it's a phallic, and a vav, above, Germanic. And quite simply, it was a drawing of the male organ pushing. It is our letter F, so all we've done is take that rude, dementary drawing there, and say, well, we'll hide it for decent geometry, and we'll call it the letter F. The F is simply a drawing of the male organ, which is why one of them is longer than the other, there, one bar, this one is the left one, usually, statistically, the other is the right one. That one is a pendant organ. It's an effing letter. It is the first letter of the word force. Now these mysteries come out of a structure of thought called Kabbalah. Now, Kabbalah is based on the letter Q. When we look at this primordial drive, we see that really we're talking about a relationship in which a situation is driven into by a penetrating force. I don't confine this down to the merely physical aspects of sexual relation in the animal or human world. Think of it cosmically. Any force, whatever, in the whole universe that pushes into any situation, which is another force but relatively passive, that is a sexual relation in the highest sense of the word. So we're not to confine that word sexuality merely to the behavior of animals and humans at the physical level. We are to remind ourselves that we're talking about cosmic energies where one of them travels through the other. We'll take our letter U here and we'll put the penetrating force there. Now that is a very simple primitive diagram of a force penetrating a situation and bending the situation that it enters into. So the word vura, you know, in Latin you say u, not the, don't you? You're supposed to say vedi vici in the best classical mode, not vedi vici and so on, right? Vedere means to know. Videre means to see, and fundamentally it is a drawing which occurs in its most primitive form as a simple scratch on a piece of stone to remind a governor of his function. Something's got to give, it doesn't have to be me. Right? So hold one hand up, grip your fingers together, your four upright fingers, as hard as you can, so that nothing can get through them, then put the thumb of the other hand in the space between two of those fingers and push, and see if you can stop with your fingers, your thumb, pushing through. Are your fingers strong enough? No, because they haven't had enough practice closing, as the thumb has in pushing. Observe that the practice of the pushing in the presence of unpracticed receivers of pushes means that somebody gives in. The one that is giving in is called vulnerable. And it's exactly the meaning of this diagram. There is always a force operating on a situation, and if the situation is relatively passive or does not gather itself together strong enough, it will be bent. Take a bit of your paper and push your finger into the paper, and the paper will give way. And the finger will represent that letter I, and the paper will represent the letter U, wrapped round it. Now, when we come to consider this, we can say, therefore, this closed situation, the letter O, penetrated by a force, the letter I, can be represented after the penetration by a U for the O, and the penetrating force going into it in that manner. So the same letter could mean either O or U, according to whether you are considering the situation to have been penetrated or not. So the very same letter, this Hebrew letter here, which is a Spanish wow, that letter can be used in Hebrew for either O or U. The very same letter, because it could be a closed situation, not yet attacked and penetrated, or it could be a situation that has been penetrated, but it would be the same letter, but you would pronounce it slightly differently. And or you would mimic, remember it begins with mimicry, you would mimic it by making a round mouth. Oh, pure, not an O-U, as in English, O, a pure Yorkshire O. Now you will feel that the mouth is like a sphere when you do that. Now then, when you've done that, push your lips forward and repeat it. You see how the O becomes mm. You cannot push your lips out while you're voicing that without changing O to O. Also, you cannot make that O sound without protruding your lips a bit. So many designs of vases were made by copying the lips, pushing forward. And we find very, very great satisfaction with certain shapes because they remind us of the fundamental of appetite. The awe, the situation, when it is about to be penetrated, can open its mouth and push its lips forward and embrace the invader, thus giving rise to that wonderful weapon used by ladies for defense against men called uterus. Uterus is the final defense of the relatively more passive. Namely, allow the invader in and then dine on him. And that was a very primitive analysis and very effective, and funnily enough, it still works. Now, when we look at the letter N, you pronounce this letter N by making the shape of an N in your mouth. I don't want to remove those. I'll ask you to think about it. The floor of your mouth, the roof of your mouth, there's the floor, there's the roof. You put your tongue from the back of your throat up towards your teeth and palate behind the teeth, so you have a shape like that. And just turn it round, and it is the letter N. You pronounce that M going N. Now you'll notice that when you do it, you have closed your mouth, but somehow air is coming up the pharynx and down the nose. So the word nose actually is nothing but an extension of the issuance of that primordial sound. Make a nice long mm. Now, isn't that a nice warm sound? But funnily enough, it means to negate in the very moment of apparently opening. I open my mouth to say yes, but I put my tongue in the position to say no, and what I say is yes. It means no, yes. The N means negation, but because you can continue to make that N sound, it is a continuant. Hence its use in the continuous forms of verbs, whether in English or French or German or Italian, whatever it is you find, singing the N in the termination ing, or the termination ant, or the termination end, the N is a constant and means continuity. So that N has a double function. It means to continue and to negate together. So if we now take the drive concept of the U and add to it the N and say UN, we are symbolizing and vocalizing a primitive sound which means moving continuously, driving continuously, the continuity of drive. So UN. As long as you keep that N going, it means you are continuing the action symbolized by the letter preceding it. So U to drive, N. UN means drive continuously. Remember that, because the word nous, nous, intelligence, means the ability to detect what is of no use and throw it away. N-O-U-S, nous, nous, intelligence, is the ability to detect what is no use and throw it away, or sell it to somebody who doesn't know it's no use. That's the mark of intelligence in humanity. Now the letter I, again the English fool you by making a diphthong, saying I-E, R-E, and if you note it with the letter A, pronounce R, and the letter I, pronounce E, and say both together I-E, I. But the reality is that that little letter should be pronounced, and is in respectable languages, E, not I. The second element in the English diphthong I-E, E is correct. It is made by a dot, E, primordial sound for a dot, and that dot is pushed through space like that and continues. And the travelling dot, or punkt, or point, or yod, or jot, means the line generator. So that when we take this word uni, we are saying push, continue to push on a line. Then we have unity of intention, unity of purpose, and a guarantee, apart from earthquakes, of success in arriving. Now we're going to the next part of the word. This means drive continuously onto the point, thus generating a line. The Q part here, the unique Q, the first letter, the Q, thrown out by the Greeks because it was too rude for their delicate souls. They retained kappa and threw out kappa. Hebrew has retained both the kappa, kaf, R letter K, and the Q. But the Q was pronounced down the well of the throat with a sort of hard coughing action, and correctly pronounced, which is quite simply a cough, like this. That is the way to pronounce Q. And you are to think of the hollow, the tone column, as they call it in bel canto, coming up from the larynx, and the air is pushing through the larynx, like that, and into the pharyngeal space. Driving through it, it is making exactly that same thing that we defined before as a sexual relation. A pharyngeal situation is penetrated by an air column, and the sound is and when you made a strong effort to do something, you did that. And primitives would pronounce it that way. Even today, if you were to travel to where there are primitive peoples, say in Australia or New Guinea or parts of Africa, you will find that in their dance motifs, when they are singing, there's lots of to go with the rhythm. And it means make super efforts if you wish to penetrate that situation. Then we have a repetition of the drive, and then we have a letter E. And the letter E is the fifth letter of the alphabet, which is a he in the Hebrew, and means life itself. A life made by a drive continuing to posit a point and push it through a resistant situation but overcoming it, continuing to drive, and this makes life unique. Now, supposing as a child, Greta, you were told this is what unique meant. That you couldn't be it unless you gathered yourself together with all your power, drove very hard, continued to do so in the presence of all opposition, on a defined point going towards a goal, and that to do this you would have to overcome resistances in the environment, and you must actually overcome them and continue to drive. And if you keep on doing this, you'll really be alive. And if you do that, you're unique, and if you don't, you're not. Now, when you were talking about the word unique in that passive way, did you think that it meant all that, the recommendation to total self-dedication of the absolute wholeness of your energy? No? Supposing you had been, what kind of a girl would you be now?
Something inside you said that I would not be a woman.
No, of course you wouldn't. You've got a tash like Lord Kitchener from World War I, and you'd be going like that, saying your country wants you. Wouldn't you? Well, do you prefer your present condition?
Do I prefer?
Yes.
I want my own uniqueness.
Your own uniqueness. But there's only one kind of uniqueness, isn't there? That which is attained by this dedicated drive. Now, if you wished to define yourself as the queen of all passivity, and you drove all your energies towards passivity, you could be a unique woman.
That seems like a contradiction.
Yeah, but it must be a possibility, mustn't it? Because passivity means the energy is accepting what is coming to it. Now, if you can accept absolutely what the universe is doing, you do what William Blake said about reality: this world is a fiction made of contradictions. You contradict yourself. You know, ordinarily you do not like to be passive unless it's pleasant. But it's actually possible to be deliberately passive when it isn't pleasant. And that really fools everybody. Yeah? So it could be possible to say, I will be what people think they mean by being feminine, and I will be deliberately, so that I'll be a secret man behaving like a woman. And I will conquer by my submission. When you do that, technically you're a Muslim. Yes.
Quite. The same drive.
That particular man in the sex change remained a man. And he deliberately behaved as if he were a woman and had anatomical alterations to make him able to behave like a woman when he was still a man. So he could do it. Likewise, any woman could do it if she could control herself and stop trying to seize the initiative. What she usually does is make herself passive when it's pleasant, and then very actively, aggressively resistant when it's not. And thus he does neither efficiently. Now, the big rule for all primordial magics of success: you must take the whole of yourself, you must aim that at a defined point, and without deviation and without any other consideration, use the totality of your energy to get there, and then you must become it. Even if it were totally self-contradictory. Because all is energy, and energy can contradict itself. Because in fact, this I and O show you. Because both of them are energy, and one has elected to stand still, and the other to push into it because it's standing still. But both of them are modalities of an infinite field of sentient power. So that infinite field of sentient power has itself chosen to be actively passive and passively active. That is the whole meaning of the cream of Hindu philosophy, the Bhagavad Gita. That Lord's song is about nothing except the art of acting without regard to the fruits of action, but with due regard to what is and is not the reality. That every situation is passive, active, active, passive, and you can choose a role of active, passive, or passive, active if you are conscious of both your possibilities. And then whichever you do, you are active, whether you're actively active or actively passive. You're still active, and therefore, by definition, male. Yeah? Now, the word unique, then, has tremendous association. Implications in a word, but most of the words that people use are not analysed in that way, and children do not acquire them in that way, and therefore they are bound by an unanalysed passive element of vocabulary with very strong emotional charges which place them at the mercy of the sound when it comes. They are conditioned in an emotive, socio-political, economic situation to respond to a word. Let's take the word work and the word play. Is it not true that they don't have the same emotive association? Why not? Well, because they have totally different meanings. Play is P-lay. You place yourself in a laying position, you make yourself passive to an impulse, to an energy, and you let that energy dictate to you what you will do, and you deliberately give into it, and it is called play. But the moment you organize yourself, that's the O-R in work, where you have a defined place and you differentiate and discriminate its content very clearly, and you fixate, lock it up so the definition can't escape, and then you drive, that's the W at the beginning, and you drive doubly, because the moment you move, you create a back motive power that opposes you to the degree that you move. So the W in the word work is to remind you that when you push, you generate opposition. And that if you're going to get on with your work, you will have to overcome the opposition, push into the situation, discriminate the contents of the situation, and tie up the situation hard so that you can't escape. Now that's work. So the word work is the opposite to the word play, isn't it? Now, you are taught, and certainly since the building of the pyramids, you are taught that organized applications of forces, of energies, of power, change situations in an orderly manner which is predetermined by some intelligent being, the workmaster. He organizes the labor force, and he makes it work. And very, very often in the ancient world, there were literally millions of people engaged on a magnificent project of architecture required to cut out 10-ton blocks of limestone and carry them and put them in position. They didn't know what they were for. They were told to do it, and there were men there to make them do it, and they did it. And this was associated with the word work. So the word work to us is irksome, worksome. Whereas when the work was down and the thing was up, everybody admired it, you could lie down a bit until the next pyramid was ordered. And when you were laying down, you were taking it easy and the sun was shining on you and you felt fine. And because of the emotive associations of thousands of years of being compelled to engage in an organization action of energy, the word work has got this association of difficulty and drive and organization, and to many minds, all things horrible that we'd rather do without. Whereas the word play means exactly to lie in the sun when you've done all the work And you're allowed off in, I think it's 52 weeks in the year, and you're allowed to couple off once or possibly twice a year by kindness of the government to get you fit to go back to work. Because they know if they work you all the time without the rest on the seventh day and your 2 weeks holiday and the gap of your 2 weeks holiday, you will undoubtedly run berserk and start screaming the place down and muck up the job. Because running berserk was very, very common when the task masters were too tough and too heavy with the whips. Somebody told me a Jewish joke a week ago about some Jews rowing down the Nile. They were slaves rowing Pharaoh's boat. And the taskmaster was lashing them away like men, and suddenly one of the Jewish rowers, slaves, turned to his friend and he said, "Lightman, how much do you tip the whipper?" Now there's very deep psychology in that, because in every situation the Jewish mind, which is based on this symbol, pronounced Yahweh, or Eu, or Jehovah in its current form, meant in every situation there's something you can get out of it already. So you're a slave rowing, and your muscles are getting better. Maybe they'll get so strong you can beat the boss in a bit. So keep quiet a bit. And if he's got a nice wife when the rowing is good, smile. Maybe she likes smiling rowers. And Joseph got promoted like that. And like Joseph, never went to refuse an offer. Remember, he refused an offer and got thrown in jail. And in jail, that's the ooh, because he refused the offer, he became a great dream interpreter and became Pharaoh's right-hand man. So it says there is no situation where you cannot capitalize on it if you're intelligent. Don't sit down and mope in jail. Get to know the warders and the other prisoners and see if they need a cigarette. See if they need something you haven't got, but you know somebody who has. That makes you a middleman. So here we are with a very simple proposition. We have imposed on us as children words without definition, but with very strong emotional charges upon them, and they are reinforced over thousands of years by continuous representation of threats. You wouldn't ordinarily think that we are daily and nightly presented with threats, would you? Unless you watch the TV and see what happens to heroes. Does not every situation show you men being shot and beaten up? Aren't you really just as presented with the threat and the offer of a thump, only disguised in the forms of plays and films and jests and so on? Now the function of the play in the ancient world was called cathartic. Now quite simply that word means enough to give you diarrhea. That's what it means. Catharsis. Think about it. It means you present a drama in which some young fellow with great intelligence objects to being a slave, either of humanity or of the gods, it doesn't matter which. All the way through that play he is going to do very well up to the last act. And the last act, you know what they used to do in the ancient world? They used to take their best actor who'd played the part, and he'd take a bow and go off. They then brought a slave in dressed like him and murdered him on stage. And that was cathartic. That made you not want to be a hero. You'd been identifying with him all the way through the play up to the time his head came off. And then you'd be the sigh of relief and applaud. What are you applauding? You're applauding that it isn't you. Now there's no other ground of applause when you go to a theatre. Think of all the people that applaud at a Beethoven concert. What are they applauding about? I'll tell you what they're applauding about. It's marvellous violin playing, but the audience didn't have to do the practice. Now anybody who's worked very hard at any skill knows that's true. To be any good at anything is murder of you. You're really a scapegoat to show what good performance means. It's absolutely exhausting. And the audience know it. They see the perspiration rolling in great lumps down the oystrak brow. My God, he's working. When it's at their pod, oh, let's go quick to the way and have a little chat about it and drink. He's trying to recover. He'll have a coronary in no time if he doesn't watch it, through his dedication to the work. And we'll always remember him. He died in harness entertaining us who don't work. So the fundamental idea of all dramatic presentations in the ancient world was to impress the audience with the unadvisability of revolutions. And this is still used for the same purpose. Now, let's apply this principle to another word. We had, didn't we, something about what's the difference between conscience and consciousness. Is there a French speaker in the house lurking about somewhere disguised? What's the word mean in French that we use for conscience in English? Has Hanukkah slipped out? Is she lurking somewhere like a midget? It's the same word. Would you mind pronouncing it down your nose like a true French girl, please? The one that we say conscience in English. Yes, conscience. Well, actually, conscience, yes? Conscience. With, together, knowledge. Now, science means SCI, which means to cut, the same root as in scissors and scythe, to cut. And the ence at the end of it means being. The essence of the thing. Science, therefore, means you take being and cut it in little bits and find out what the bits are, and when you know what the bits of a thing are, in relation to that thing, you are a scientist. Now, therefore, a rationalist people like the French say this conscience is consciousness, because by means of cutting it to pieces, you become conscious of the parts as well as the whole. Now, it has an emotive association engrafted upon the word in English, that it's something that makes you feel awful, isn't it? Conscience. Think of that double N in it. Say the word conscience and let the N's last a bit. Conscience. Isn't it horrible? It's very, very impeding. Your totality of knowledge is your conscience. And that's why conscience is not a valid ground to justify or condemn any activity. Because your conscience, your conscience, your knowledge changes as you develop and grow up and learn. Your knowledge extends, and consequently your conscience extends, so your conscience is really very flexible and will not do for an absolute statement of the truth. Your conscience, acquired through cutting your sense organ data up, that conscience is changing every day and is not a valid ground for making a pronouncement about anything other than the particular things it has cut to pieces.
Why does conscience mean clarity?
Well, every time you think about what you know about a thing, and when you think about what you'd really like to do if you didn't know about it, for instance, there's a lady sitting next to you, isn't there? She's the wife of the man next to her. And when you remember that, your knowledge inhibits you. Right? So conscience doth make a coward of you. The word coward means Q-guarder. Q-warder. Q-guarder. Guard your genital organ. You know what they used to do? And they would reintroduce in certain parts of Iran today, if you're naughty, they'll cut it off. And when you remember that fact, if you think it's worth keeping, you become a coward. That is a cue guard, because you've remembered that society doesn't let you do it. Thus, conscience doth make cowards of us all. But then the other part goes with it. And thus the native hue of resolution is sickly all with the pale cast of thought. Now how many times do people find themselves where their will is one thing, and their conscience, their total intellectual furniture, is another. And the will would do this. And the conscience said, yes, but somebody's looking. There are cameras in Liverpool in a certain position, and they're trained on the roads. And if they like to play back the records of those, they can see one fellow breaking the rules and get his number from that record. And he can be found and charged because he's been watched. And this is happening more and more and more. Any time there's a public demonstration, the ringleaders are photographed by TV cameras. The whole film is examined to see who's got the initiative. And then the ones with the initiative can be picked up and removed and everything goes quiet. There are only 5% of people with any initiative, so it doesn't need much to sort people out, really. So here we are, with primary sound, which we have learned as babies, without adequate definition, but with emotional charges that actually control our lives. Now, what are we going to do about it, if anything? How very interesting. And then forget all about it. Now this depends entirely on the temperament of the person. If the person who hears that wishes to develop full, total efficiency of life function in himself or herself, then the obvious thing to do is get to know more and more about these primordial roots of words and how their emotive associations were accreted to those words. Because once you understand how they got there, then you can begin to release yourself from them. Let's take a word like the word man. Now man is made of a base, ma, which means mother. Doesn't matter whether you go to darkest Lancashire or highest Altai Himalaya. Go to Tibet and say, what is the name of the feminine ruling power of the universe? And they say, Ma. So it doesn't matter whether you go in the Chinese takeaway in Chorlton or whether you go to Tibet. Ma is Ma everywhere. Why? Because closed mouth, is the primary sound that woman makes to herself when she's contented. And it's the same sound that baby makes when he's being breastfed. There's a little term called yumming. You know the word yumming in yum, yum, yum? That's copied from babies nursing. And they've got the mouth full and therefore closed. But when they're satisfied, they feel like a little girl going mum, 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 mum. So probably their first word will be, unless you hit them hard suddenly, ma, not pa. You go mum, 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 mum. So that word, that primary root, ma, the mother principle, was actually the base of the word man. And when somebody offered from what we've already said, how did it get the N on the end of it? What turned mind to man? Negation. Now how can you become a man if you don't finally break from your ma? You have to be able to say no to ma. You know, very often a full-breasted woman with a child, she's got more than the child needs. And at some point the child turns away. So this goes ma and goes Now if he does it effectively, it's called man. The woman is then very proud, you see, because, oh, this is a little fiend, I must keep hold of him. must chase away all other women, because when his father dies, he'd be in love with half about the house. Because he can say, Marlene. And you will notice this peculiar sound in naughty boys, they love it. Have you noticed it? That little boys, when you push them, they go, You see, Ma, primordial substantial appetite, M-A. Nah. The negative activity turns Ma into Man. And this negation is another word for self-control. Negation and control and discipline and every word of any value whatever in relation to efficiency is based on negative controls. That is, you take your absolute, infinite, primordial appetite and you get hold of it and tie it up. And when you can tie up your own energy deliberately from within yourself, you have turned from Ma to Na. And that same double, Mana, in Polynesia, is called magical power. There's a whole theory amongst anthropologists about this mysterious power of Mana. It's really very simple. The fellow who can control his own appetite and conceal it is much better off than the fellow who goes about, as they say in primitive language, gawping. Oh. How would you like to walk about like that all day? You think you're a member of Mama, wouldn't they? Yeah? Now, when you're able to negate that and shut your mouth so that somebody doesn't know that you want to grate, and you imagine a small boy standing before a bowl of grapes, and he's only a visitor in the house, and you go, what does the owner of the grapes think? I've actually seen this happen. I remember as a child myself going, oh, this is great. And some ladies in the houses, do you know what they used to do? Quietly remove the grapes. Well, if you kept your mouth shut and looked through the window, you thought, what a tinsy winsy little appetite that child has got, and walked out of the room. And then, of course, the grapes went, so the ability to hush your mouth was very, very, very important. And the only difference between a king, a priest, and a commoner was the ability primarily to keep the mouth shut, not gawp about the place, to negate one's own appetitive tendencies, and thereby to become man. Now, supposing when you were at school and you were doing a bit of elementary anthropology and the teacher said to you, you are a member of mankind. And that means you are a rational being. What would you say to that? What's he trying to do to you if he says you are a member of mankind? Turn you up. Well, first of all, you've got to be man. That's negate your appetite. Then you won't be such a pest in society. And then you've got to be kind as well. And kinder means, remember your kin, your kith and your kin, your family, and divide your family, that's the letter D at the end, from all other families. And then you are kind. So if you're born a Bavarian, you are kind to Bavarians in principle. And if you meet an Italian, you are not kind. You don't have to be kind to an Italian because you are not of that kind. So the wars in Scotland that allowed the English to conquer the Scots were wars where a clan in this little valley and a clan in this valley were distinct. They were not kin. There was no kinship there. And no necessity for kindness because they were not of kin. And the people who wished to control their tribes always tied them up with the definition of difference. Now, the most extreme form of this definition of difference was invented by the Jewish thinkers who brought forth the concept of the chosen people of God. They said that God has a unilateral pact to make one peculiar people into the people that would eventually benefit the whole of mankind. To Abraham a promise, in him shall all the nations of the world be blessed. And coming out of that line, through the David the king, and the scepter shall not pass from there until Shiloh comes. Till he, whose it is by right, arrives, the authority remains in that line. Now, Christianity was built by a Jew who revolted against the idea that only one people was elect of the human race, and said, no, this dispensation was made for all lineage descendants of Adam. And that was a great revolt against the idea that a particular people, whom today we call the Israelis, were the only elect people, elected by God. And this Jewish fellow, Jesus of Nazareth, said, no, it isn't true. It is from Adam where the election is. God made man as opposed to sub-man, as opposed to apes. He made man there to rule on earth. And he is the elect of all living beings. The human race is elect. So he said that. Now, after that came Muhammad, amongst an Arabian people who were largely polytheistic, and he realized that they needed reformation. But what had been said of the one God by the Jewish prophets, there is one God, and his name is one, his power is one, and there is no other God. But that was kept to a select people, and it had to be spread. And Jesus had said he came to fulfill that law by reminding them that the human race were included, and not merely a little section of them. Muhammad came and said the same thing, and therefore he said, you must recognize that the people of the book, that is the Jews and the Christians of his day, were telling you about the one God as opposed to the many gods. And there is only one God, and that God is absolute power, absolute intelligence, infinite comprehension, and that no finite individual human being in a body can usurp the position of the invisible, all-intelligent power. But we have to cooperate with the Jews, because they were the inventors of the monotheistic concept. There is only one supreme God. In India you've got literally thousands and thousands of gods, and they're all more or less on the same level and worth worshipping. Although they have a concept of a super god in India, how far that concept borrowed from the Judaic concept through trade relations, the scholars differ. And then we have this Muslim statement, which carries on the dispensation of Christianity and of Judaism. There is only one God, and all human beings, all in the line Adamic, as it says in the Quran, all of the Adamic line are the elect, as opposed to the animal world, and the vegetable world, and the mineral world. It is this human world. Now, if that is so, if you care to read in the Quran, you will see there that the Jews who are true Jews and the Christians who are true Christians are accepted by Muslims who are true Muslims. And the rule is very simple in the Quran. If you do not give to another person that which you would like for yourself, you are not a Muslim, you are not a Christian, and you are not a Jew. Only if you are prepared to give to other people what you value for yourself and share it with them, are you a true Muslim. That means to say that Iraq and Iran fighting for the sole possession of a port in the Gulf are not Muslim, though both sides say they are. They're not truly Muslim, because each side wants the control, but by Muslim law he should want the control for the other side as well as for himself. Now, how many Muslims are true Muslims? How many Christians are true Christians? How many Jews are true Jews? To be any one of those three religions, you have to say all human beings are identical genetic protoplasm. They're really extensions of the same being, and in principle can cooperate. And all they have to do, in fact, is do what they can do in principle. Now that is all hidden in terminology, taught people and not defined adequately, but emotive tones are built up. So there are people who were born in a certain civilization and brought up as Muslims in Iran, in Iraq, in Turkey and elsewhere, as others were brought up Christian and others were brought up Jew. And there they are, and today they are fighting each other. And many of them, by the hundreds of thousands, are giving up that religious belief in favour, say, of communism, to fight against that religious teaching, when what they should be fighting against is the corruption of it, not the teaching. The teaching of the unity of the human race is absolutely true. The teaching of the necessity for intelligent cooperation is absolutely true. The abuse of that teaching by any given section is no disproof of the truth of the teaching. So when we get all these differences, apparently, of sectarian religions, it is terminology that has created that difference. Terminology undefined. Because, you get a simple thing, Muslim is related to certain people who believe in the Prophet Muhammad. But the same word exists in Hebrew and means exactly the same thing. It means submission. So Muslim and Muslim both have the same meaning, and one is Arabic and the other is Hebrew. And they both mean submission to the will of God. And Abraham, therefore, was a Muslim. So we see an undefined term with an emotive association can be very dangerous. So unless we get to the bottom of this terminological difference and release ourselves from the emotive overtones of it, we will remain continuously at war with each other, either openly or covertly. And when the next war is fought, as a big convention of scientists recently said, and the system breaks down, there is a high probability that the condition will be like primitive man before there was a system to help them to relate, and they're roving bands like wolves destroying each other as they meet. There'll be total chaos. That is a prediction by some scientists today for what is likely to happen. Now, as long as people have erroneous ideas derived from undefined vocabulary charged with emotive associations, the high probability of that happening is with us. So it is for each individual to decide how much energy is available to investigate fundamental concepts. Let's take the word love again. The word love, we've dealt with it before. You can't deal with it too often. People learn this context in a situation where there's babies. I love you is accompanied with a gesture, arms round, and you feel comfortable and relatively warm. And I hate you, it has a different facial expression and a pushing away with it. So the word love tends to mean emotively arms round and comfy. That's not its meaning. The word means labouring for the development of the potentialities of being. So you don't love anybody unless you work for their development. That is the only valid meaning of that combination of primary phonetic elements. You have an L there, which means the work factor, the lamed, the lambda, an ox goad, drive yourself, bind yourself to the situation, the O, for V, the development, of E, the life. So to drive oneself in every situation, to develop the life potential of that situation, is love. Anything less than that is not love. It doesn't matter what we call it. It may have nothing to do with arms round and cuddliness. It may have to do with the opposite. It might have to do with telling somebody very clearly, but not dogmatically, but clearly, that certain factors are better taken into consideration than not. And then that person, having been told, is not to be compelled to do it, because the highest respect has to be given to the free will of every individual being as a zone of activity of that infinite universal power, which itself posits us and of which we are modalities. So we see that this unique word has tremendous significance, doesn't it? And conscience, we had another one, didn't we? What was the other one? Principle before practice.
Fact before fallacy.
Principle before practice.
Yeah.
You didn't mention the fallacy last time, did you?
No, I didn't. The
fact before fallacy.
Before fancy, yeah.
Before fancy or fallacy?
Fancy.
Fancy. Did you say fallacy a moment ago?
Can I say?
No, did you?
No, it didn't say that.
No, but did you?
No.
Did anybody hear you say fallacy?
No.
I did, and I think I've got some agreeance. And it could be that fallacy and fantasy are all mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that they're both mixed up with sexuality.
Yeah.
Because all fantasy, you know the word fan is a euphemism for the lady's genital department, isn't it? And it means vanity, which means that which vanishes, and that means the opposition that collapses under attack. And that was attributed to the female that gave in when pressed hard. And the fallacy was to believe that it wouldn't, and therefore never to try. Think how much nervousness there is in men who are only ma, and very often not quite in na yet, because the maturation of man is the ability to negate the ma in himself. Think how many of these ma and beings have not attained full self-negation power over their own appetite, and in consequence are terrified of their own female aspect inside themselves. They're afraid of running amok because of their own feelings of unformedness within. And because of that unformedness, possibly overriding their logic, they are frightened also of external women. You know that lots of men are intimidated by the feminine? They really are. It's understandable, because when they were about so big and Mama was nursing them, occasionally, playfully, she choked them. And then said, I could choke you, or I could eat you. And the child, it has happened before. I mean, it has happened. Not only rabbits eat their young, barmaids do. You never seen a barmaid with a baby, have you? You can't say they're celibate. So, we have this strange fact that the man afraid of the feminine in his own being, because of its irrationality, tends also to be afraid of the feminine outside him in the woman, and therefore to be ruled by women through unconscious fears of their non-rational capacities, because they can behave in such a way that only a masculine negation power, which is called intellect, is flooded out of existence by a sudden irrational tantrum. So that fallacies and fantasies arise where the fallacy is not sure of itself. It's not sure that when it's presented with an opposition that it has the capacity to gather itself together and drive through it.
Is that why high academic people sometimes appear very...
And the more intellectual you prefer to be, the more evidence there is that you're afraid of the non-rational. Why bother to stabilize yourself with intellect? unless you think something could override you. I mean, after all, intellect is only a tool to give you a technique of attaining your volitional ends. So you get a lot of highly intellectualized men that are quite feminine in their own self, very much either mother dominated or afraid of women, and particularly afraid of their own irrationality. And therefore they throw themselves into self-intellectualization to make themselves secure. Now, principles before practice. Imagine a situation where protoplasm, and that's all we are, organized in more or less complex ways. Protoplasm originally was quite simply a kind of colloidal shaking mass in a primitive ocean. Only later did it fall onto centers and make monocells. So its first sentient experience of itself is one of a diffused, not adequately defined, tremulous anxiety. It's not yet made itself into a being. It has not yet got a center. And then, somehow mysteriously, some scientists think it was caused by lightning striking into this chemical mess, caused a falling onto centers of the chemistry of that primal ocean, and there appeared little dark spots in little masses of protoplasm. And that little spot is the letter I, the dot on the I, the yod of the Kabbalah. It is the principle of individuation, the principle, a pyra in that place, a principle. Because from the moment that that centralization has occurred, then the infinite universal power pressing into that center pushes through that center, and the center is a little transformer, and it pushes out to the periphery of that primitive cell and pushes the cell out and begins to move about in search of food. The principle, therefore, is that pi-rational behavior that arises from the first positing of a central nucleus in the protoplasm. Then the pyra actis, having got this principle, this pi-rational center, then you begin to activate through the center. Because before the center, the whole mass, with no little dark dots in it, was a blubbering, shaking, tremulous, vaguely sentient, anxious, numbing, with no demarcation. But from the moment of that center, the energy can go through the center to its periphery, push it out, make pseudopodia, make false legs, extend them, deposit calcium in them, make bones, produce the vertebrates, and so on, finally up to man himself. And he does it by pyra activation practice. Instead of waiting for the stimulus to hit him from outside, he feels inside when the stimulus comes whether the stimulus is worthy of his attention. If it is worthy of his attention, his tension, he tenses on it, he holds it, and he activates himself on his evaluation of the worthwhileness of the stimulus. Not the stimulus determines him, but his evaluation, made by his nuclear will, determines what he will do. And when that is done, from center, the pyra, the rational function, in the nucleus of that egg, gives the orders from in the nucleus by its own self-evaluation of the importance of the stimulus, and it pushes out, and it shapes itself in accordance with its judgment. And that shaping is called worth shape, which later was contracted to the word worship. So that all true worship starts in the center of being, and defines the kind of being that it wills to become. He sits down and writes its definition so it doesn't forget it. And then, having defined it, it activates itself on the basis of its own definition, and therefore makes itself into a shape which is worthwhile to it, because it conforms to its own definition on that shape which is most efficient for the pursuit and attainment of a goal defined from within the centre of being. And that is absolute self-determination. When a being does that adequately, it means that the infinite power of the absolute sentience has posited that protoplasm, entered it, set up a little reference point within it, that yod point, that jot, and then pushing through that little jot has organized that protoplasm in a very individuated, unique way. And that is a total fulfillment of the will of the absolute for that being. That being is then unique, has a conscience, that is a totality of knowledge to date, and a practice of a principle, and a method of overthrowing fantasies and escaping fallacies. So that all of these things come together. And we arrived at this by starting with a simple little word. Can we say that the definition, when we look at that word now, is quite the same as it was when we were babies? No. Can we say that, why bother with it? It's useless? Or can we say that's very useful? That means I have a principle inside my own being which is absolutely central, which is absolutely valid, which in religious terminology is God positive, as stated in the book of Genesis, God breathed the spirit of life into man. And he became a living soul, a solo, a being on its own, there, within, on its own, because it owes to the absolute this positing, within a universe with infinities of other such centers, all posited by the same absolute, and therefore to whom we have a peculiar kind of cosmic relation, such that if we behave in the relational, intelligent, purposive, mutually loving equals developmental way, we are doing two things simultaneously: the will of God and the certain development of our own talent.